of Harry Potter over his fame-hungry head, a ruse that Dumbledore was to repeat 4 years later when another teacher needed to be persuaded to come back to school. By subtly suggesting that teaching Harry Potter would set the seal on Lockhart's fame, Dumbledore had set a lure that Lockhart could not resist. By the time that he arrived at school, Lockhart's magical skills, once rather good, had become rusty, almost beyond repair. The only spell for which he had real ability was the memory charm, which he had been using repeatedly for years. His classes quickly became a charade, as he was revealed to be completely inept at everything in which he claimed, in his books, to be expert. The accident that cost Lockhart his sanity occurred at the end of his year at Hogwarts, when he was hit by a backfiring memory charm that forever erased his past. He has since resided in the Janus Thickey ward of St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries.
The Daily Prophet. For Wizarding World celebrities like Gilderoy Lockhart, being covered by the Daily Prophet is something to aspire to. That's why Lockhart is so excited to see Harry enter Flourish and Blotts as he signs copies of his autobiography. "Together, you and I are worth the front page," he tells Harry as a Prophet photographer snaps their picture. When you're as fame-hungry as Lockhart, such excitement is understandable. Those in the magical community don't watch television or engage with internet culture, so even today, the Daily Prophet remains one of the only channels guaranteed to be seen by most of the UK's wizarding population. This makes it very influential, both as a source of news and of gossip. Because as Lockhart instinctively understands, and as Harry finds out, gossip has a currency all of its own.
There is only one wizarding newspaper in Britain, discounting such small circulation publications as the Quibbler. The Daily Prophet, whose headquarters are in Diagon Alley, is delivered by Owl on a daily basis to nearly every wizarding household in Britain. Payment is effected by placing coins in the pouch tied to the paper owl's leg. Occasionally, when something particularly interesting or exciting happens, such as the illegal flight of a Ford Anglia the length of Britain, an Evening Prophet edition will be rushed out. The Prophet is not an entirely unbiased source of news, and sometimes displays an unfortunately sensationalist tendency best epitomised by star reporter Rita Skeeter. Ostensibly an independent news source, it has more than once been influenced by the ministry, or ruling power of the day, to hush up certain stories. A clue to its overriding motivation may be found in its name. Prophet being a homonym of profit, meaning for financial gain. Although I was also taken with the idea of a wizarding newspaper claiming foreknowledge of news to come. Wizardkind tends to not require alternative political flavours in its news coverage, which is not to say, however, that the Prophet does not have a political agenda. As a small, outsider and occasionally beleaguered community, wizards are, by and large, interested in the same kinds of stories. The Quidditch League results, whether anyone is in trouble for infractions of the International Statute of Secrecy, what irritating legislation the misuse of Muggle Artifacts Office has come up with now, and when the next Celestina Warbeck or Weird Sisters concert will take place. It seems likely that wizards will continue to favour old-fashioned newsprint, even while the Muggle world resorts increasingly to the internet. If Muggle newspapers had moving photographs, their circulation might be similarly buoyant.
There are many ways to be famous in the wizarding world, but few celebrity stories come close to Harry Potter's. It seems surviving Voldemort's killing curse as a baby is a surefire way to see your name regularly appear in the Daily Prophet for the rest of your life. No wonder it made Harry uncomfortable. Having a talent for singing or alchemy or even memory charms would definitely be preferable. Chapter 11. Wizarding Transport. Flying around on a broomstick is all well and good, but not everyone has a head for heights. Plus, soaring over the heads of muggles atop a firebolt in Nimbus 2001 would be a bit of a giveaway. So what's a witch or wizard to do if they have a trip to take and a broomstick is out of the question? The good news is there are many options. Because whatever Harry might think, flying a firebolt is not the only way to travel. Some of the alternative options, like the steam-powered Hogwarts Express, or Arthur Weasley's magically modified Ford Anglia, might look familiar to muggles, but there are plenty of others that are unique to the wizarding world. Hold on to your wands, everybody. There might be some bumps on the road ahead, not to mention ash in the fireplace. The Flu Network. Harry's first experience of travelling through the Flu Network is a memorable one. Coughing on ash from the Weasleys' fireplace, he misspeaks the words Diagon Alley and somehow ends up in neighbouring Nocturne Alley. An easy mistake to make when you've never relied on a fireplace for transportation before. As we will see though, it isn't only newbies whose garbled pronunciation causes problems on the line. The Flu Network might be quick, but it seems no method of mass transportation is perfect. Not even when it involves magic.
In use for centuries, the Flu Network, while somewhat uncomfortable, has many advantages. Firstly, unlike broomsticks, the network can be used without fear of breaking the International Statute of Secrecy. Secondly, unlike apparition, there is little to no danger of serious injury. Thirdly, it can be used to transport children, the elderly, and the infirm. Nearly every witch or wizard home is connected to the Flu Network. While a fireplace may be disconnected by the use of a simple spell, connection requires the permission of the Ministry of Magic, which regulates the flu service and prevents muggle fireplaces becoming inadvertently joined up, although temporary connection can be arranged in emergencies. In addition to domestic fireplaces, there are around 1,000 fireplaces across Britain connected to the flu network, including those at the Ministry of Magic and various wizarding shops and inns. The fireplaces of Hogwarts are not generally connected, although there have been occasions when one or more has been tampered with, often without the staff's knowledge. Although generally reliable, mistakes can happen. Speaking the name of the destination loudly and clearly upon entering the flu flames is sometimes difficult due to ash, heat and panic. The most notorious instance of accidental misdirection happened in 1855 when, after a particularly nasty row with her husband, witch Violet Tillyman leapt into the living room fire and cried between sobs and hiccups that she wanted to go to her mother's house. Several weeks later, with no clean pots in the house and his socks in urgent need of washing, her husband Albert decided that it was time she came home and took the flu network to his mother-in-law's. To his surprise, she claimed that Violet had never arrived. Albert, a suspicious man and a bit of a bully, raged, stormed and searched the house, but his mother-in-law appeared to be telling the truth. A poster campaign and a series of articles in the Daily Prophet later, Violet had still not been found. Nobody seemed to know where she was, and nobody had seen her come out of any other fireplace. For several months after her disappearance, people were afraid to take the flu network in case it simply vanished them into thin air. However, time passed, memories of Violet faded, and nobody else disappeared, so the wizarding community continued as usual. Albert Tillyman returned grumpily to his house, learned cleaning and darning spells, and never used the flu network again for fear of what it had done to his wife. It was not until 20 years later, after Albert's death, that Violet Tillyman resurfaced. Due to the incoherent way she had spoken when she had entered the flu network, she had not emerged from her mother's fireplace, but that of Myron Otherhouse, a handsome wizard who lived in Bury St. Edmunds. In spite of Violet's tear-stained, ash-covered and blotchy appearance, it had been love at first sight when she toppled out of his fire, and Myron Violet, and their 7 children lived happily ever after.
Author's note. Flue came from the flue that you find on a chimney. And don't ask me to tell you exactly what a flue is, because I don't know. I just know it exists, but I'm not sure what it does exactly. I needed a way for particularly young witches and wizards to travel around because I'd created the International Statute of Secrecy, which was inconvenient. So immediately that made it quite difficult for them to move around, particularly over long distances by magical means. So I thought they need something very discreet, and that's how the flue network came about. So it was a way of moving from house to house without ever being seen by muggles. But it was fun and comical to have it a little bit difficult to use so that you could easily make a mistake in where you ended up.
Flue powder. The flue network can only be accessed by flue powder, a glittering concoction that, when thrown onto a connected fireplace, causes the fireplace to erupt into emerald flames. All a witcher wizard must then do is step into the flames and announce their desired destination. A few sickening spins later, and out they tumble. Well, unless they're trying to visit a boarded-up muggle fireplace, like the one in the Dursleys' house. In that case, the travellers, Arthur, Fred, George and Ron Weasley, find themselves trapped, leaving Arthur no choice but to blast the Dursleys' electric fireplace out into their living room. Talk about arriving with a bang. It's also possible to use flue powder to literally pop your head in on a friend or family member, as when Harry visits Sirius at Grimmauld Place, whilst kneeling on the cold floor of Professor Umbridge's office at Hogwarts. A little disorienting, perhaps, but it's one way to get FaceTime.
Flue powder was invented by Ignatia Wildsmith in the 13th century. Its manufacture is strictly controlled. The only licensed producer in Britain is Fluepow, a company whose headquarters is in Diagon Alley and who never answer their front door. No shortage of flue powder has ever been reported, nor does anybody know anyone who makes it. Its price has remained constant for 100 years. 2 sickles, a scoop. Every wizard household carries a stock of flue powder, usually conveniently located in a box or vase on the mantelpiece. The precise composition of flue powder is a closely guarded secret. Those who have tried to make their own have been universally unsuccessful. At least once a year, St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries reports what they call a faux flu injury. In other words, somebody has thrown a homemade powder onto a fire and suffered the consequences. As irate healer and St. Mungo's spokeswizard Rutherford Polk said in 2010,
"It's 2 sickles a scoop, people, so stop being cheap. Stop throwing powdered rune spore fangs on the fire and stop blowing yourselves out of the chimney. If one more wizard comes in here with a burned backside, I swear I won't treat him. It's 2 sickles a scoop."
The night bus. As getaway vehicles go, at first glance, the night bus is not particularly discreet. Big, violently purple, and driven at speed by an elderly wizard called Ernie Prang, the night bus comes to Harry's rescue in Prisoner of Azkaban, right after he has blown up Aunt Marge and run away from the Dursleys. But muggles can't see it, so Ernie and conductor Stan Shunpike are free to travel about the country rescuing magical folk in need, unrestricted by speed limits or road signs. What's the story behind the big bus then? As Stan says, "Take her away, Ern."
For witches and wizards who are flu sick, whose apparition is unreliable, who hate heights, or who feel frightened or queasy taking portkeys, there is always the night bus, which appears whenever a witch or wizard in urgent need of transportation sticks out their wand arm at the curb. A purple triple-decker bus, it has seats during the day and beds at night. It is not particularly comfortable, and I would advise against ordering hot drinks, even if offered, because the bus's habit of leaping from one destination to another at a moment's notice can result in a lot of spillage. The night bus is a relatively modern invention in wizarding society, which sometimes, though it will rarely admit it, takes ideas from the muggle world. The need for some form of transportation that could be used safely and discreetly by the underage or the infirm had been felt for a while, and many suggestions had been made. Sidecars on taxi-style broomsticks, carrying baskets slung under thestrals, all of them vetoed by the ministry. Finally, Minister for Magic Dugald MacPhail hit upon the idea of imitating the Muggles' relatively new bus service, and in 1865, the night bus hit the streets. While some wizards, mainly pure-blood fanatics, announced their intention of boycotting what was dubbed this Muggle-esque outrage in the letters page of the Daily Prophet, the night bus proved hugely popular with most of the community and remains busy to this day.
Author's note. The night bus was so named because, firstly, night, with a K, is a homonym of night, the period from dusk until dawn. And there are night buses running all over Britain after normal transport stops. Secondly, night, with a K, has the connotation of coming to the rescue, of protection, and this seemed appropriate for a vehicle that is often the conveyance of last resort. The driver and conductor of the night bus in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban are named after my two grandfathers, Ernest and Stanley.
Portkeys. The ability to transport yourself from one part of the country to another by means of something innocuous like an old boot is one of those magical things that sounds too good to be true. And as it turns out, it's not quite as simple as bewitching a cast-off item and clutching it to your chest every time you want to disappear. Shame.
Wizards who cannot apparate, dematerialise and reappear at will, who wish to travel by daylight, meaning that broomsticks, thestrals, flying cars and dragons are inappropriate, or whose destination has no fireplace, rendering flue powder useless, will have to resort to the use of a portkey. Almost any inanimate object can be turned into a portkey. Once bewitched, the object will transport anyone who grasps it to a pre-arranged destination. A portkey may also be enchanted to transport the grasper or graspers only at a given time. In this way, the arrivals and departures of great numbers of witches and wizards can be staggered, enabling such events, such as the Quidditch World Cup, to take place with few security breaches. When secrecy is paramount and mass movement is planned, the chosen portkey will be a nondescript object secreted in an out-of-the-way place, so that it will be taken for a piece of unimportant debris by Muggle passers-by. Accidents have occurred, however. Two Muggle dog walkers found themselves accidentally transported to a Celestina Warbeck concert in 2003 because their dogs had run off with an old trainer on Clapham Common, leaving an anguished crowd of witches and wizards to look frantically for their portkey on a stretch of empty grass, hopefully seizing old crisp packets and cigarette ends. One of the Muggle dog walkers was even invited on stage by Celestina to perform a duet of A Cauldron Full of Hot Strong Love. While the memory charm placed upon him by a harried ministry official seemed to take at the time, he has since written a popular Muggle song that bears an uncanny resemblance to Celestina's worldwide hit. Miss Warbeck is not amused. The sensation of travelling by portkey is universally agreed to be uncomfortable, if not downright unpleasant, and can lead to nausea, giddiness, and worse. Healers recommend that the elderly, pregnant, and infirm avoid using portkeys. The suggestion of arranging portkeys for the transportation of annoying relatives has saved many a wizarding family Christmas.
Author's note. The name portkey comes from the French porte, to carry, and the word key in the sense of secret or trick.
Chapter 12. The Journey to Hogwarts. Portkeys might be a great travel solution for mass gatherings at Wizarding World events, but as we will see, they are less suitable when it comes to transporting students from across the country to Hogwarts' unconfirmed Scottish location. This begs the question, how did young witches and wizards get to school before the Hogwarts Express first steamed its way onto platform 9 3/4? This train is about to depart, so climb aboard and settle in. The Hogwarts Express. For Harry, the Hogwarts Express is more than just a magically adapted scarlet steam train. It is the engine which transports him into his new life. Watching the world whiz by his window as the Hogwarts Express picks up speed and takes him far, far away from the Dursleys, Harry's excitement is clear. As Harry reflects as the train pulls out, he didn't know what he was going to, but it had to be better than what he was leaving behind. But Harry is by no means the first student to make the journey to Hogwarts. And as we will see, the Hogwarts Express itself has also taken a pretty circuitous route to platform 9 3/4. So how did a Muggle steam train end up transporting hundreds of witchcraft and wizardry students from central London to the Scottish Highlands? Time to inspect this engine.
As we know from early historical accounts and from the evidence of early woodcuts and engravings, Hogwarts students used to arrive at school in any manner that caught their fancy. Some rode broomsticks, a difficult feat when carrying trunks and pets. Others commandeered enchanted carts and later carriages. Some attempted to apparate, often with disastrous effects, as the castle and grounds have always been protected with anti-apparition charms. Others rode a variety of magical creatures. In spite of the accidents attendant on these various modes of magical transport, not to mention the annual Muggle sightings of vast numbers of airborne wizards travelling northwards, it remained the responsibility of parents to convey their children to school right up until the imposition of the International Statute of Secrecy in 1692. At this point, it became a matter of urgency to find some more discreet method of transporting hundreds of wizarding children from all over Britain to their secret school in the Highlands of Scotland. Portkeys were therefore arranged at collecting points all over Britain. The logistics caused problems from the start. Up to a third of students would fail to arrive every year, having missed their time slot or been unable to find the unobtrusive enchanted object that would transport them to their school. There was also the unfortunate fact that many children were, and are, portkey sick, and the hospital wing was frequently full to bursting for the first few days of every year, while susceptible students overcame their hysterics and nausea. While admitting that portkeys were not an ideal solution to the problem of school transportation, the Ministry of Magic failed to find an acceptable alternative. A return to the unregulated travel of the past was impossible, and yet a more secure route into the school, for instance, permitting a fireplace that might be officially entered by flue powder, was strongly resisted by successive headmasters who did not wish the security of the castle to be breached. A daring and controversial solution to the thorny problem was finally suggested by Minister for Magic Ottoline Gamble, who was much intrigued by Muggle inventions and saw the potential in trains. Where exactly the Hogwarts Express came from has never been conclusively proven, although it is a fact that there are secret records at the Ministry of Magic detailing a mass operation involving 167 memory charms and the largest ever mass concealment charm performed in Britain. The morning after these alleged crimes, a gleaming scarlet steam engine and carriages astounded the villagers of Hogsmeade, who had also not realised they had a railway station. While several bemused Muggle railway workers down in Crewe spent the rest of the year grappling with the uncomfortable feeling that they had mislaid something important. The Hogwarts Express underwent several magical modifications before the Ministry approved it for school use. Many pure-blood families were outraged at the idea of their children using Muggle transport, which they claimed was unsafe, insanitary, and demeaning. However, as the Ministry decreed that students either rode the train or did not attend school, the objections were swiftly silenced.
King's Cross Station. For all its magical modifications, a Muggle-engineered train like the Hogwarts Express requires a Muggle-engineered railway to run on, which means it must depart from a Muggle train station like King's Cross. All very reasonable. But when the magical world meets the Muggle one, the only thing that stands to reason is that reason, but not magical train services, must sometimes be suspended.
When Ottoline Gamble commandeered a Muggle train to serve as the new mode of transport for Hogwarts students, she also had constructed a small station in the wizarding village of Hogsmeade, a necessary adjunct to the train. The Ministry of Magic felt strongly, however, that to construct an additional wizarding station in the middle of London would stretch even the Muggles' notorious determination not to notice magic when it was exploding in front of their faces. It was Evangeline Orpington, minister from 1849 to 1855, who hit upon the solution of adding a concealed platform at the newly Muggle-built King's Cross Station, which would be accessible only to witches and wizards. On the whole, this has worked well, although there have been minor problems over the ensuing years, such as witches and wizards who have dropped suitcases full of biting spellbooks, or newt spleens all over the polished station floor, or else disappeared through the solid barrier a little too loudly. There are usually a number of plain-clothed Ministry of Magic employees on hand to deal with any inconvenient Muggle memories that may need altering at the start and end of each Hogwarts term.
Author's note. King's Cross, which is one of London's main railway stations, has a very personal significance for me, because my parents met on a train to Scotland, which departed from King's Cross Station. For this reason, and because it has such an evocative and symbolic name, and because it is actually the right station to leave from if you were heading to Caledonia, I never knew the slightest indecision about the location of the portal that would take Harry to Hogwarts, or the means of transport that would take him there. It is said, though where the story originated I could not tell you, it is suspiciously vague, that King's Cross Station was built either on the site of Boudicca's last battle. Boudicca was an ancient British queen who led a rebellion against the Romans, or on the site of her tomb. Legend has it that her grave is situated somewhere in the region of platforms 8 to 10. I did not know this when I gave the wizard's platform its number. King's Cross Station takes its name from a now-demolished monument to King George IV. There is a real trolley stuck halfway out of a wall in King's Cross now, and it makes me beam proudly every time I pass.
Platform 9 and 3 quarters. To access Platform 9 and 3 quarters, as Molly Weasley tells Harry,
all you have to do is walk straight at the barrier between platforms 9 and 10. Don't stop and don't be scared you'll crash into it. That's very important.
Which sounds a little indiscreet, but at least it beats a ticket barrier. See you on the platform.
Author's note. In choosing the number of the concealed platform that would take young witches and wizards to boarding school, I decided that it would have to be a number between those of the Muggle platforms. Therefore, it was clearly a fraction. This raised the interesting question of how many other fractional platforms lay between the whole numbered platforms at King's Cross, and I concluded that there were probably quite a few. Although these are never mentioned in the book, I like to think that it is possible to take a version of the Orient Express off to wizard-only villages in continental Europe, try platform 7.5, and that other platforms may be opened on an as-required basis. For instance, for large one-off events, such as Celestina Warbeck concerts, see your ticket for details. The number 9 3/4 presented itself without much conscious thought, and I liked it so much that I took it at once. It is the three quarters that makes it, of course.
Chapter 13. Sorting. Once a first year steps off the Hogwarts Express to board one of Hagrid's little boats, the next phase of their Hogwarts experience begins. Across the glassy lake, through a curtain of ivy and along a dark tunnel they travel. The boats land near a passageway in the rock, which leads to some stone steps and eventually to Hogwarts' huge oak front door. It's all very atmospheric. And that's before anyone gets to the sorting ceremony. The phrase sorting ceremony is vague enough for older students to create fear in their first year siblings. Fred Weasley told Ron it involved wrestling a troll. But what it actually involves is trying on the sorting hat and waiting for it to shout out what house you'll do best in, based on what it sees inside your head. Sounds a little less intimidating than troll wrestling, but even if you don't become a hat stall, and no, that's not a magic spell, having your head examined in a hall full of people you've barely met is not exactly fun either. Let's sort this out once and for all then. The sorting hat. So exactly how clever is the sorting hat? And is it always accurate in its assessment of a student's house? Gryffindor, Slytherin, Ravenclaw, or Hufflepuff? It likes poking around inside first year's brains, but now the time has come to turn this hat on its head and really find out what it's made of.
The famous Hogwarts Sorting Hat gives an account of its own genesis in a series of songs sung at the beginning of each school year. Legend has it that the hat once belonged to one of the four founders, Godric Gryffindor, and that it was jointly enchanted by all four founders to ensure that students would be sorted into their eponymous houses, which would be selected according to each founder's particular preferences in students. The sorting hat is one of the cleverest enchanted objects most witches and wizards will ever meet. It literally contains the intelligence of the four founders, can speak through a rip near its brim, and is skilled at legilimency, which enables it to look into the wearer's head and divine his or her capabilities or mood. It can even respond to the thoughts of the wearer. The sorting hat has another ability, which has rarely been revealed to anyone at Hogwarts. It is a magical portal, by which another of Godric Gryffindor's possessions may be accessed, the Sword of Gryffindor. This sword was enchanted by Godric to appear whenever a member of his house asks for help while wearing the hat. Twice in the course of the Harry Potter series, the sword is transported from a temporary owner to aid a Gryffindor who needs a weapon. The sorting hat is notorious for refusing to admit it has made a mistake in its sorting of a student. On those occasions when Slytherins behave altruistically or selflessly, when Ravenclaws flunk all their exams, when Hufflepuffs prove lazy yet academically gifted, and when Gryffindors exhibit cowardice, the hat steadfastly backs its original decision. On balance, however, the hat has made remarkably few errors of judgment over the many centuries it has been at work.
Author's note. The sorting hat does not appear in my earliest plans for Hogwarts. I debated several different methods for sorting students, because I knew from early on that there would be four houses, all with very different qualities. The first was an elaborate Heath Robinson-ish machine that did all kinds of magical things before reaching a decision, but I did not like it. It felt at once too complicated and too easy. Next, I placed four statues of the four founders in the entrance hall, which came alive and selected students from the throng in front of them while the school watched. This was better, but still not quite right. Finally, I wrote a list of the ways in which people can be chosen. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, short straws, chosen by team captains, names out of a hat. Names out of a talking hat. putting on a hat. The sorting hat.
Hat stall. Ever heard of a hat stall? Well, it's what happens when the sorting hat can't make a quick decision. It is comforting to know that even an enchanted object containing the intelligence of four different people doesn't always have an immediate answer. Nothing leaves you in suspense like a hat stall.
An archaic Hogwarts term for any new student whose sorting takes longer than 5 minutes. This is an exceptionally long time for the sorting hat to deliberate, and occurs rarely, perhaps once every 50 years. Of Harry Potter's contemporaries, Hermione Granger and Neville Longbottom came closest to being hat stalls. The sorting hat spent nearly 4 minutes trying to decide whether it should place Hermione in Ravenclaw or Gryffindor. In Neville's case, the hat was determined to place him in Gryffindor. Neville, intimidated by that house's reputation for bravery, requested a place in Hufflepuff. Their silent wrangling resulted in triumph for the hat. The only true hat stalls known personally to Harry Potter were Minerva McGonagall and Peter Pettigrew. The former caused the hat to agonize for 5.5 minutes as to whether Minerva ought to go to Ravenclaw or Gryffindor. The latter was placed in Gryffindor after a long deliberation between that house and Slytherin. The sorting hat, which is infamously stubborn, still refuses to accept that its decision in the case of the latter may have been erroneous, citing the manner in which Pettigrew died as dubious evidence.
Chapter 14, The Hogwarts Curriculum. Once the sorting is over, the welcome feast has been eaten, and the students have spent their first night in a Hogwarts dormitory bed, it's time to get down to business. And that means lessons. A Hogwarts school timetable might look fantastical, but there's still plenty of hard work involved. From the focus required by Professor Sprout in Herbology, to the torpor generated by Professor Binns's distinctly unmagical teaching style in History of Magic, almost every class at Hogwarts is a lesson in the unexpected. Besides, as if the subjects weren't tricky enough, there are the teachers to contend with. For Harry, Professor Snape is by far the worst. In 5 years of their potions lessons together, never once does Snape miss a chance to take points off Harry, or to favour the students of his house, Slytherin. And while Snape's animosity may stem from his intense dislike of Harry's father, James, he is by no means the only teacher whose classroom is subject to its own set of rules. Professor McGonagall has high standards for her Transfiguration students. Arguably, so too does Professor Trelawney, although exactly what those standards are remains suitably opaque. As for Defence Against the Dark Arts, Harry and his class have so many teachers over the years, it is difficult to maintain any standards, though Professor Umbridge's lessons are a particular low point. Still, not even a magical school can be all fun all the time, and when you're learning how to cast spells, brew potions and fly brooms, there are also plenty of high points. So timetables at the ready. Let's take a deep dive into the Hogwarts curriculum. Pay attention, class. There's a lot to cover. Hogwarts school subjects. First years first. What is on a new Hogwarts student's timetable then? It's time to pack up those book bags and venture out into the school corridors.
All first years at Hogwarts must take 7 subjects. Transfiguration, Charms, Potions, History of Magic, Defence Against the Dark Arts, Astronomy and Herbology. Flying lessons on broomsticks are also compulsory. At the end of their second year at Hogwarts, students are required to choose a minimum of 2 more subjects from the following list: Arithmancy, Muggle Studies, Divination, Study of Ancient Runes, and Care of Magical Creatures. Very specialised subjects, such as alchemy, are sometimes offered in the final 2 years, if there is sufficient demand.
Author's note. A slightly different list of school subjects appears in my earliest notes. Herbology is called herbalism. Divination is compulsory from the first year, as are alchemy and a subject called simply beasts. Whereas transfiguration is called Transfiguration/Metamorphosis.
Professor McGonagall. By the time Harry arrives at Hogwarts, Professor Minerva McGonagall is already long established. Not only is she Harry's firm but fair transfiguration teacher, she is also the fiercely proud head of Gryffindor House and Albus Dumbledore's scrupulously loyal deputy. In later years, McGonagall becomes Hogwarts headmistress in her own right, an obvious choice, as she proves just as staunch a defender of Hogwarts as her old friend Dumbledore. In Cursed Child, McGonagall even shares her particular wisdom with a second Albus, Harry's son, named for the headmaster who had once advised him. The lesson even your father sometimes failed to heed is that bravery doesn't forgive stupidity. Always think. Think what's possible, McGonagall told Albus Potter, thus proving that Dumbledore was not the only Hogwarts head with a knack for shrewd observations. But that's the Professor McGonagall her students know. So what of Minerva before Hogwarts?
Minerva McGonagall was the first child and only daughter of a Scottish Presbyterian minister and a Hogwarts-educated witch. She grew up in the Highlands of Scotland and only gradually became aware that there was something strange both about her own abilities and her parents' marriage. Minerva's father, the Reverend Robert McGonagall, had become captivated by the high-spirited Isabel Ross, who lived in the same village. Like his neighbours, Robert believed that Isabel attended a select ladies' boarding school in England. In fact, when Isabel vanished from her home for months at a time, it was to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry that she went. Aware that her parents, a witch and a wizard, would frown on a connection with a serious young muggle, Isabel kept their burgeoning relationship a secret. By the time she was 18, she had fallen in love with Robert. Unfortunately, she had not found the courage to tell him what she was. The couple eloped to the fury of both sets of parents. Now estranged from her family, Isabel could not bring herself to mar the bliss of the honeymoon by telling her smitten new husband that she had graduated top of her class in charms at Hogwarts, nor that she had been captain of the school Quidditch team. Isabel and Robert moved into a manse, minister's house, on the outskirts of Caithness, where the beautiful Isabel proved surprisingly adept at making the most of the minister's tiny salary. The birth of the young couple's first child, Minerva, proved both a joy and a crisis. Missing her family and the magical community she had given up for love, Isabel insisted on naming her newborn daughter after her own grandmother, an immensely talented witch. The outlandish name raised eyebrows in the community in which she lived, and the Reverend Robert McGonagall found it difficult to explain his wife's choice to his parishioners. Furthermore, he was alarmed by his wife's moodiness. Friends assured him that women were often emotional after the birth of a baby, and that Isabel would soon be herself again. Isabel, however, became more and more withdrawn, often secluding herself with Minerva for days at a time. Isabel later told her daughter that she had displayed small but unmistakable signs of magic from her earliest hours. Toys that had been left on upper shelves were found in her cot. The family cat appeared to do her bidding before she could talk. Her father's bagpipes were occasionally heard to play themselves from distant rooms, a phenomenon that made the infant Minerva chuckle. Isabel was torn between pride and fear. She knew that she must confess the truth to Robert before he witnessed something that would alarm him. At last, in response to Robert's patient questioning, Isabel burst into tears, retrieved her wand from the locked box under her bed, and showed him what she was. Although Minerva was too young to remember that night, its aftermath left her with a bitter understanding of the complications of growing up with magic in a muggle world. Although Robert McGonagall loved his wife no less upon discovering that she was a witch, he was profoundly shocked by her revelation and by the fact that she had kept such a secret from him for so long. What was more, he, who prided himself on being an upright and honest man, was now drawn into a life of secrecy that was quite foreign to his nature. Isabel explained through her sobs that she and their daughter were bound by the International Statute of Secrecy, and that they must conceal the truth about themselves or face the fury of the Ministry of Magic. Robert also quailed at the thought of how the locals, in the main, an austere, straight-laced and conventional breed, would feel about having a witch as their minister's wife. Love endured, but trust had been broken between her parents, and Minerva, a clever and observant child, saw this with sadness. Two more children, both sons, were born to the McGonagalls, and both, in due course, revealed magical ability. Minerva helped her mother explain to Malcolm and Robert Jr. that they must not flaunt their magic, and aided her mother in concealing from their father the accidents and embarrassments their magic sometimes caused. Minerva was very close to her Muggle father, whom in temperament she resembled more than her mother. She saw with pain how much he struggled with the family's strange situation. She sensed, too, how much of a strain it was for her mother to fit in with the all-Muggle village, and how much she missed the freedom of being with her kind and of exercising her considerable talents. Minerva never forgot how much her mother cried when the letter of admittance into Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry arrived on Minerva's 11th birthday. She knew that Isabel was sobbing, not only out of pride, but also out of envy. School career. As is often the case where the young witch or wizard comes from a family who has struggled with its magical identity, Hogwarts was, for Minerva McGonagall, a place of joyful release and freedom. Minerva drew unusual attention to herself on her very first evening, when she was revealed to be a hat stall. After 5.5 minutes, the sorting hat, which had been vacillating between the houses of Ravenclaw and Gryffindor, placed Minerva in the latter. In later years, this circumstance was a subject of gentle humour between Minerva and her colleague Phileas Flitwick, over whom the sorting hat suffered the same confusion, but reached the opposite conclusion. The two heads of house were amused to think that they might, but for those crucial moments in their youths, have exchanged positions. Minerva was quickly recognized as the most outstanding student of her year, with a particular talent for transfiguration. As she progressed through school, she demonstrated that she had inherited both her mother's talents and her father's cast iron moral sense. Minerva's school career overlapped by 2 years with that of Pomona Sprout, later head of Hufflepuff House, and the two women enjoyed an excellent relationship both then and in later years. By the end of her education at Hogwarts, Minerva McGonagall had achieved an impressive record. Top grades in OWLs and NEWTs, prefect, head girl, and winner of the Transfiguration Today Most Promising Newcomer Award. Under the guidance of her inspirational Transfiguration teacher, Albus Dumbledore, she had managed to become an animagus. Her animal form, with its distinctive markings, tabby cat, square spectacle markings around eyes, were duly logged in the Ministry of Magic's Animagus Registry. Minerva was also, like her mother, a gifted Quidditch player. Although a nasty fall in her final year, a foul during the Gryffindor versus Slytherin game, which would decide the cup winner, left her with concussion, several broken ribs, and a lifelong desire to see Slytherin crushed on the Quidditch pitch. Though she gave up Quidditch on leaving Hogwarts, the innately competitive Professor McGonagall later took a keen interest in the fortunes of her house team and retained a keen eye for Quidditch talent. Early heartbreak. Upon graduation from Hogwarts, Minerva returned to the manse to enjoy one last summer with her family before setting out for London, where she had been offered a position at the Ministry of Magic, Department of Magical Law Enforcement. These months were to prove some of the most difficult of Minerva's life, for it was then, aged only 18, that she proved herself truly her mother's daughter by falling head over heels in love with a Muggle boy. It was the first and only time in Minerva McGonagall's life that she might have been said to lose her head. Dougal MacGregor was the handsome, clever, and funny son of a local farmer. Though less beautiful than Isabel, Minerva was clever and witty. Dougal and Minerva shared a sense of humour, argued fiercely, and suspected mysterious depths in each other. Before either of them knew it, Dougal was on one knee in a ploughed field, proposing, and Minerva was accepting him. She went home, intending to tell her parents of her engagement, yet found herself unable to do so. All that night she lay awake, thinking about her future. Dougal did not know what she, Minerva, truly was, any more than her father had known the truth about Isabel before they had married. Minerva had witnessed at close quarters the kind of marriage she might have if she wed Dougal. It would be the end of all her ambitions. It would mean a wand locked away, and children taught to lie, perhaps even to their own father. She did not fool herself that Dougal MacGregor would accompany her to London while she went to work every day at the ministry. He was looking forward to inheriting his father's farm. Early next morning, Minerva slipped from her parents' house and went to tell Dougal that she had changed her mind and could not marry him. Mindful of the fact that if she broke the international statute of secrecy, she would lose the job at the ministry for which she was giving him up. She could give him no good reason for her change of heart. She left him devastated and set out for London 3 days later. Ministry career. Though undoubtedly her feelings for the Ministry of Magic were coloured by the fact that she had recently suffered an emotional crisis, Minerva McGonagall did not much enjoy her new home and workplace. Some of her co-workers had an ingrained anti-Muggle bias which, given her adoration of her Muggle father and her continuing love for Dougal MacGregor, she deplored.
Welcome to the Ministry of Magic.
Though a most efficient and gifted employee, and fond of her much older boss, Elphinstone Urquhart, Minerva was unhappy in London and found that she missed Scotland. Finally, after 2 years at the ministry, she was offered a prestigious promotion, yet found herself turning it down. She sent an owl to Hogwarts, asking whether she might be considered for a teaching post. The owl returned within hours, offering her a job in the Transfiguration Department, under head of department, Albus Dumbledore. Friendship with Albus Dumbledore. The school greeted Minerva McGonagall's return with delight. Minerva threw herself into her work, proving herself a strict but inspirational teacher. If she kept letters from Dougal MacGregor locked in a box under her bed, this was, she told herself firmly, better than keeping her wand locked there. Nevertheless, it was a shock to learn from the oblivious Isabel, in the middle of a chatty letter of local news, that Dougal had married the daughter of another farmer. Albus Dumbledore discovered Minerva in tears in her classroom late that evening, and she confessed the whole story to him. Albus Dumbledore offered both comfort and wisdom, and told Minerva some of his own family history, previously unknown to her. The confidences exchanged that night between two intensely private and reserved characters were to form the basis of a lasting mutual esteem and friendship. Marriage. Through all her early years at Hogwarts, Minerva McGonagall remained on terms of friendship with her old boss at the ministry, Elphinstone Urquhart. He came to visit her while on holiday to Scotland, and to her great surprise and embarrassment, proposed marriage in Madame Puddifoot's tea shop. Still in love with Dougal MacGregor, Minerva turned him down. Elphinstone, however, had never ceased to love her, nor to propose every now and then, even though she continued to refuse him. The death of Dougal MacGregor, however, although traumatic, seemed to free Minerva. Shortly after Voldemort's first defeat, Elphinstone, now white-haired, proposed again during a summertime stroll around the lake in the Hogwarts grounds. This time, Minerva accepted. Elphinstone, now retired, was beside himself with joy and purchased a small cottage in Hogsmeade for the pair of them, whence Minerva could travel easily to work every day. Known to successive generations of students as Professor McGonagall, Minerva, always something of a feminist, announced that she would be keeping her own name upon marriage. Traditionalists sniffed. Why was Minerva refusing to accept a pure-blood name and keeping that of her Muggle father? The marriage, cut tragically short, though it was destined to be, was a very happy one. Though they had no children of their own, Minerva's nieces and nephews, children of her brothers Malcolm and Robert, were frequent visitors to their home. This was a period of great fulfillment for Minerva. The accidental death of Elphinstone from a venomous tentacular bite 3 years into their marriage was an enormous sorrow to all who knew the couple. Minerva could not bear to remain alone in their cottage, but packed her things after Elphinstone's funeral and returned to her sparse stone-floored bedroom in Hogwarts Castle, accessible through a concealed door in the wall of her first-floor study. Always a very brave and private person, she poured all her energies into her work, and few people, except perhaps Albus Dumbledore, ever realized how much she suffered. Author's note: Minerva was the Roman goddess of warriors and wisdom. William McGonagall is celebrated as the worst poet in British history. There was something irresistible to me about his name, and the idea that such a brilliant woman might be a distant relative of the buffoonish McGonagall. A small sample of his work will give a flavour of its unintentional comedic value. The following was written as part of a poem commemorating a Victorian railway disaster.
Beautiful railway bridge of the Silvery Tay, alas, I'm very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time.
Anna Magi. Professor McGonagall is the first Hogwarts teacher to appear in Philosopher's Stone, but this is not immediately obvious because she is A, in her animal form, that of a stern, map-reading tabby cat, and B, in a very Muggle environment. As a registered animagus, McGonagall's cat-like appearance on Privet Drive may be unusual, but it is not in breach of any Wizarding World laws. The same cannot be said, however, of another animagus in Harry's life, Sirius Black, who once follows Harry through the suburban streets surrounding the Dursley family home whilst in his animal form of a large black dog. Because while Sirius and his marauder pals James Potter and Peter Pettigrew were, like McGonagall, animagi, they were also, unlike McGonagall, not registered. So how is all this important? Why can some witches and wizards transform into animals while most can't? And what is this register all about?
An animagus is a witch or wizard who can transform at will into an animal. While in their animal form, they retain most of their ability to think as a human, their own sense of identity and their memories. They will also retain normal human life expectancy, even if they take their animal form for long periods of time. However, feelings and emotions are simplified, and they will have many animal desires, feeding off whatever their animal body craves, rather than demanding human food. It is immensely difficult to change oneself into an animagus, and the process, which is complex and time-consuming, can go dramatically wrong. As a result, it is believed that fewer than 1 in 1,000 witches or wizards are animagi. An animagus has a great potential advantage in the spheres of espionage and crime. For this reason, an animagus registry exists on which all animagi are expected to log their personal details and the precise appearance of their transformed self. It is usually the case that distinctive markings or disabilities belonging to the human body will transfer to the animal self. Failure to enter oneself onto the registry may result in a stretch in Azkaban. When the process of becoming an animagus goes wrong, it often goes seriously wrong. Impatience with the long and complicated process is generally at the root of such disasters, which usually take the form of horrible half-human, half-animal mutations. There is no known cure for such mistakes, and those who make them are often forced to live out their days in their pitiable condition, being unable to become fully animal or fully human. Talent in both transfiguration and potions is necessary to become an animagus. No responsibility can be taken